Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Fuel your day with Green Fern's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Thanks to Jenny Green, it's Thursday the 7th of October and this is Game On. Coming up today, the Gaelic players have their say on football championship reform.
Having a guaranteed 7 competitive championship games in the summer will develop teams. Another one is fairness. We want to end the brutal mismatches that we see in the current structure. This allows teams to compete against each other at a similar level.
In rugby, Bernard Jackman is in studio as Connacht take issue with how they're perceived.
The Connacht opposition tonight, what do you know about them?
A lot of Leinster players who come down from Leinster. Obviously the guys who didn't get contracts up there come down. Yeah, it's very similar to, you know, a couple of franchises we have in South Africa. When they don't get contracted by the big unions, they go down to the small provinces and then obviously try and find a way in which they can get noticed by the bigger provinces.
I just thought Jack's comments were ill-informed, to be honest with you. Yes, we have Leinster players, as does every team in the country. You can only fit a certain amount of players into their squad, so there is going to be a transition of players to other squads.
Plus in soccer, we have former FAI chief Noel Mooney on his new role with Welsh football, and David Snaid is in studio to talk Azerbaijan, Nations League and Newcastle United Saudi takeover.
Game on 2FM.
If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On. David, Bernard, very welcome to studio. Hope you're both doing well. We are going to get straight into the football and look, the Saudi takeover of Newcastle United. The Premier League confirmed the sale a little bit earlier. It's a 300 million plus takeover from Mike Ashley and it leaves the Saudi Public Investment Fund with the majority stake in the club. David, what are your initial thoughts about this?
Just the latest chapter in how the Premier League is, and this the latest takeover. Before we came into the studio, we kind of saw clips of Newcastle fans jumping around St James's Park, celebrating, singing "We have our club back." And you kind of look at it from two points of view. Like, you can't ignore the fact that Amnesty International have come out strenuously about this, and you look at the Saudi Arabian human rights record, and it just cannot be ignored when you look at everything that's happening with sports washing in Premier League and throughout Europe and in sport in general. And then if you're looking at it purely from what a football club is to its supporters and what's happened to that football club in the northeast of England and what those fans have been through with an owner that has really decimated the club and stripped it bare essentially for his own gain, you'd have to have a heart of stone not to see a little bit of joy for those supporters who haven't had a lot over the last 15 years.
We'll get into it in more detail a little bit later on, but Bernard, you'd have to have a thought for Steve Bruce. He's one game away from managing 1,000 games and now he's in a situation where they will have their pick of any manager that they want. How difficult is it for a manager to be in a situation where they probably know with the new owners coming in that they could be in bother?
Yeah, I think it creates instability, it creates uncertainty, and certainly for Bruce, he'll hope to get a couple of good results early just to calm those new owners down. I suppose Dale will probably take sound bites or feedback from supporters groups, whatever the left is, the management, to see should they make a change quickly. You know, do the fans want to change quickly? But certainly for Steve Bruce, my last year in Grenoble, our benefactor passed away and we had a change of president, and our president was an absentee president in that he was a Frenchman who lived in LA. So just being able to get in touch with him, being able to have him around the office at the right time certainly didn't lead to harmony with the players. We'd also asked players to take a pay cut. So it was quite a contentious time, and not having a president, which is basically like an owner, on site certainly wasn't helpful.
To be no Newcastle players getting the pay cut now, I can tell you.
Absolutely not. And I've seen the names now already been linked with Newcastle. They're talking Mbappe, they're talking Haaland, they're even talking about going after Salah. Like, they're really aiming high. And sure, why wouldn't they now? They're in the money, right? There are a lot of concerning aspects to that takeover as well, and we will chat them through a little bit later on. But first of all, we are going to turn our attention to Gaelic games. Damien Lawler is with us. Look, Damien, there's no fear that anyone's going to be taking over any of the counties around Ireland anyway. We know that they're all pretty safe, but there's a good chance that there might be change to the championship structures though. And I know that the GPA had a press conference a little bit earlier. They gave their backing to Proposal B, which is the Summer League Championship format. They reckon that it will ignite the Gaelic Football Championship, but it is still very hard to get a consensus on whether or not there will be change, Damien.
Absolutely, Marie. So there's that option that you mentioned there, and there's option A as well, which is four groups by eight in provincial groups, which would see counties moving provinces as well. And really, that's not really with the ethos of the GEA at all. That motion has no chance. You know, they both require 60% to get change invoked, and it's questionable whether option B will get 60%. I wouldn't say it's a million miles away from it, but the talk seems to be that it might just not be at the 60% mark yet, Marie, which would make it, I suppose, make us all go back to the status quo, which is the current qualifier system. And even then, there's chats that the Super 8 format won't be permitted to go forward any further, that it hasn't maybe struck an imagination with the public. So the Super 8s look to be in trouble. So I would imagine that if the 60% mark isn't reached, that the status quo will prevail. Current qualifier system will be back in tow. But the GPA today certainly made a good effort about nailing their colours to the mast, and, you know, providing evidence of why they did so, and providing high profile players to speak out on their behalf also.
Well, let's hear from the GPA CEO, Tom Parsons.
Today is about reflecting the voice of the players, and the players unanimously and strongly have come out in front of option B, and there's a few reasons for that. One is the development of players and teams. Having guaranteed seven competitive championship games in the summer will develop teams. Another one is fairness. We want to end the brutal mismatches that we see in the current structure. This allows teams to compete against each other at a similar level. And the third one is we need the Tailteann Cup to work. The Tailteann Cup is linked to promotion, so there's an inherent incentive there to compete in the Tailteann Cup. We believe from the GPA and all the surveys and conversations that we've had with players and managers that this will help ignite Gaelic football.
Tom, you've put your colours to the mast. How important is it for other stakeholders to come out now, like maybe the Governing Association, and maybe say what they back also?
The 23rd of October is a key date. Between now and that date, we need people to come out. We need to have the debate, the conversation. This is a very significant vote. And I think people's opinions need to come out, whether it's for Proposal A or Proposal B or the status quo. The players have come out strongly. We're willing to have that debate and that conversation with anybody else. But this deserves that level of debate and that level of education. I think our Gaelic family needs to look at some of the videos and have an opinion on, will this ignite Gaelic football? Is it the right thing to do? We've done that, and I believe between now and the 20th of October, more leaders in the GAA and our Gaelic family will come out and express their views.
I know you won't look beyond that date. Traditionally, 60% margins are hard to gain in congresses. If it doesn't go the GPA's way, or the way the GPA wants, Tom, I still get the sense this is only the start of a process, that maybe the GPA won't relent on maybe lobbying for change in the future.
We're only thinking of the 23rd of October, and we're in a place and time now where we have a very robust proposal that the GEA have put out there. They've commissioned a task force to pull these proposals together. We need to respect that date and not look beyond that date. And the key message is, between now and that date, let's educate ourselves, let's have the debate, and let's get to the 23rd of October with a very core reason why in what you're voting for.
Tom Parsons, the GPA CEO, speaking to yourself, Damien, a little bit earlier. So, Damien, look, what he says there, that we need to have the debate, and like he's quite right. Like, there isn't really much of a debate about it. The players have said what they think. A couple of people have come out and maybe given their opinions on it, but we've had very little really on it from a lot of the stakeholders.
Yeah, I know, completely right, and everything that Tom said there it's fair, I think. The managers, Marie, earlier in the season, I mentioned on your show, the intercounty managers had a WhatsApp group during COVID, and I won't say all of them, but the stark majority of them favoured the league championship format. The GPA, now responsible for the intercounty players, they've come out and said that they want the league championship format as well. Whatever about the top brass of the GEA keeping neutral and keeping objective on this, which I understand, I think maybe certainly other units of the association need to come out and maybe just even give their views and educate it. And in fairness to Brian McAvoy of the Ulster Council, he came out very much against it this week. And, you know, he gave his views, and you have to respect him for putting his head out and doing that as well. I don't know if people fully realise how significant this landmark is on Gaelic football's journey, Marie, because there's a definite apathy. Even one of the games, we'll say, that you covered this year, Mayo versus Leitrim, and I covered Down versus Donegal. Like, the appetite for those type of games is not there anymore, and Longford's Mickey Quinn mentioned to me this morning that a lot of his teammates check the draw in November to see if it's worth their while staying on to commit for the next season or not. And again, hearing that younger intercounty players just really won't stick around for the status quo. So we're at a critical juncture, I think, in the makeup of Gaelic football. Traditionally, emotive motions like this don't always get through on first chance. Mm-hmm. They might get close to 60% and they might need to be redrafted over the next year or two, but I'm not so sure if the patience will last much beyond that. I think the provincial councils cannot be underestimated here. The role that they play in the financing, the administration, the governance, the games calendar, they play a massive, massive role, and they need to be reassured that their job spec and that their roles won't be diminished or undervalued. In Plan B, provincial championships are still retained, just played at an earlier junction in the season. But I don't think there's enough talk about it or debate about it. And people won't always agree with the GPA, but they certainly come out and nail their colours, certainly to Mast on this one, and they backed up their reasons for doing so. And I guess now it'll be interesting to see if other stakeholders come forward. I think you've had individual managers no more than Colm Collins on this show and that in the past. They've been speaking about it, but very few seem to want option A. It's a question now of whether it'll be B or the status quo.
It's very hard to engage people in matters going to Congress, though, because it just all seems so ponderous.
Yeah, and on that note, I think all the intercounty players, from what I can see from my research on the ground, I spoke to the Leitrim chairman today, Marie, and I was asking him about what way they vote on this, and he just said strictly they're going to be dictated to by the players and by the new manager. And the chairman, Enda Stenson, was making the point that he's not the guy who spends 300 days a year on the field, that the players are, and he'll be told by them. So there's an intense lobbying process underway already, and it'll only ramp up in the next couple of weeks. So I think while the debate itself may be ponderous on the day, in that, you know, not everybody gets their spoke across, I think they'll all be well informed going in there as to what way their county boards and their county committees, in terms of playing squads, also will want them to vote.
So you mentioned Leitrim there, and they do have a new manager in Andy Moran, which will surely breathe life into the county anyway.
Well, it's a great way of putting it. Andy was in big demand by maybe at least two counties looking for him as a potential manager, and another maybe one or two counties looking at him as a potential coach. The process to replace Terry Hyland has been underway for 2 months. Andy's been involved in that every step of the way. He was one of the first to apply for the job. He was one of the first that Leitrim spoke to. And again, from chatting to the chairperson today, he is just blown over by the appointment. Just in terms of the status, the energy, the enthusiasm that Andy Moran commands as a player and a personality. But he was also bowled over by the fact that maybe while they might have liked to appoint Andy a week or two ago, he wasn't ready to do so himself yet, because his entire backroom team wasn't in place. And he's a meticulous guy by nature. And Enda Stenson, the chairperson, is very, very impressed by that. In terms of what could possibly be achieved, relatively speaking, going forward. I think also in terms of retaining younger players' interest in the county, it's massive. During the COVID period, and obviously we're still in a COVID period, but during the earlier COVID period, Leitrim got together both here and abroad, Leitrim people, to raise money. They raised 100,000 plus for their county. That created an almighty buzz. This has done so all over again, and I think that this is a young squad that has worked together maybe from under 16 upwards, and they're now at an age of their mid-20s with developing squads coming through. So Andy Moran will hold two sets of trials, I'm told. He'll give everybody a fair crack. He'll leave nobody behind. But he really wanted to wait and see if the players and county board were as committed to the task as he was. So it's all to play for. It's a high-profile appointment, Marie. And for a county like Leitrim, you know, down the divisions, it breeds life. I couldn't put it any better, really. It breeds life back into it.
We know that he has a great football brain as well, and we've seen the way the game has evolved over the last number of years as well, and what can be, what can happen when you have somebody in charge who is almost ahead of the curve and helping to shape the game, as Andy Moran has on so many occasions. Yeah. And look, just while we're on the topic of Andy's, there could be a new manager in Meath. It's been widely reported that Andy McEntee will not be going forward as the manager of Meath into the next season.
Yeah, I mean, I think the full county board has to have a look at that now again. So, I mean, if you look at Meath's performance this year, they came from 11 points down to launch a stirring comeback against Dublin. Looked to be massive excitement there. The irony here, Marie, is that there was huge excitement with the Meath ladies footballers and the Meath minors winning two All-Ireland titles in the space of 8 days. And even the minor manager, Conall O'Brick, was moved from that post straight away to a post-minor squad, which has identified a clear target for Meath to retain their players from minor to under 20 in adults. So all look to be going swimmingly, to be quite honest about it. I believe McEntee was subject to a review, as was the Meath hurling manager, so there was no surprise there. You had a hiccup earlier in the year whereby maybe the under 20 management at the time, Bernard Flynn's group, felt that they weren't getting full access to their players, and he stepped aside, and that certainly was a bit of a blow to the Royal setup. But this is probably maybe left of centre. A narrow vote from the county board executives went against Andy. It probably does put obstacles in the way for him to be going forward again. But again, it's October. Is there a ready-made replacement there? I'm not so sure. All the talks were that maybe there was a bit to left. There was a bit left on the road that McEntee had to travel, but that he would be coming back to see it out in a third season, a final season. It may not be the case now, and it's I suppose it's indicative of this time of year where there is a managerial merry-go-round. But they've left it late enough now. They've left it quite
really
late.
Have. As have Galway too, Damien.
Yeah, Galway. I mean, Brian Hanley would be a key contender for that position there, Murray. But I see it rumoured again during the week that Micheál Donoghue could be back in the race as well. And it appears to be maybe between those two. The last I heard, Micheál was in the frame, but maybe had withdrawn his name. Don't think it'd be like him to withdraw and then put his name back into it. So it's a bit messy. And I think with the concluding stages of the county championship, you want to be in pole position, really. Now, the gas thing about it is both Donoghue and Hanley would know those players inside out, and indeed with Geoffrey Linsky if he's still involved as well. But yeah, I think really and truly, pre-season training, as ridiculous as this sounds, won't be along around the corner in starting.
That's
and
for
once
sure.
Special Congress is out of the way and everybody knows where they stand and everybody knows the makeup of the new season, you start looking to, and then you look to your backroom team and you look to your finances and your budget and locations and logistics. And Bernard will testify to this, every manager or coach wants to have a good road ahead planned out, and those two counties are at a bit of a disadvantage straight away, so it'll be turbulence there too.
Yeah, there might even be foreign training camps coming back. Who knows, Damien? Thanks so much, as always, for joining us. We're going to take a very quick break now.
Dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range, available in selected stores nationwide.
2FM on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On with me, Marie Crowe. I'm in studio with David Snaid and Bernard Jackman. David, the last 24 hours, the news cycle has been very much dominated by the vaccine hesitancy from some of the Ireland players and I guess the wider football community. And I'm looking at the number of players who have opted out from getting the vaccine. Callum Robinson really bore the brunt of it over the last day or so because he revealed that he has decided at this moment in time not to get the vaccine. Just given the situation that Stephen Kenny has been in over the last 18 months or so with COVID, do you think that he should have come out stronger on it, that he should be somebody that says, you know what, I have responsibility to not just the players that I'm picking here, but also the backroom staff and everybody to not bring people on into camp and two away games and two games that haven't been vaccinated?
Yeah, personally, yes, I think he should have. I think he does have a responsibility to other players in the squad, backroom staff who work around the squad and FAI staff who might be in and around that bubble of being in with the senior team. But again, it comes to the point of view, is he in a position at the moment where he's able to do that? He kind of said it would be radical to take that stance and maybe not include players who haven't taken the vaccination. I'd be coming from the point of view of you're representing your country, it's an honour. It's not your livelihood, so you're not stopping someone from earning a living by saying to them, well, actually, you haven't taken this vaccine, so we're going to keep you kind of at arm's length for the time being. I think he would have been well within his rights to do that. No other country really has taken that stance, but just because maybe other people haven't done it, I don't think you should have to follow. Maybe you can take the lead and set an example. But then it's also come from a point of view of where Ireland are at the moment and maybe some of the players who he might be having to do without. And the bare facts of it are that Ireland need every single player that they can get of quality to try and get a win that will be really is needed for him. like I think Callum Robinson of a small, well, I do have a fair bit of, I'd say, kind of sympathy for him, in the sense that he came out at the start of this week and was very open, was honest about it. He fronted up the question. He could have easily batted away like so many other people have. He's one of these players who will always speak to the media. He's a very affable guy. Like, he's not one of these people who you come away speaking to and think that he wouldn't be a team player, kind of thing, you know what I mean? He always strikes you as a decent fella. It was one of those sentences where he wasn't able to get into the ins and outs of what his reasoning was for not having the vaccine. The fact it is, you just have to respect that is his decision. He is someone who, again, has missed games because
he's had COVID twice,
exactly. And it's just another thing that is kind of overshadowing another big week for Stephen Kenny. But what's interesting is, just over the last couple of days, and speaking to people on coaching staffs in Premier League clubs and players in Premier League dressing rooms, who, it's like they don't want to put their head above the parapet a little bit because they've kind of seen what's happened over the last couple of days and don't want to speak out. But it's very clear that part of the issues that within Premier League dressing rooms are, is like, I always would have been of the assumption that because they're getting privately tested twice a week still, that clubs would have these vaccinations on offer for their players at the training ground. And as it was put to me by one person at a Premier League club, that if that was the case and they didn't have to go to the NHS like the rest of the public in the UK, players would probably line up and actually have it taken, that there's a part of the issue that they have to go and do it off their own bat, which seems extraordinary.
And without insulting them, they're probably not used to doing a huge amount for themselves, because they'll have been in setups, they'll have been in academies since they were kids, and so many footballers, when they retire and they leave the club setup, they talk about having to just learn to live in the normal world again, which is make their own dinner, do their own washing, get their own travel organised, and that's the reality for them.
That's it. And again, listen, Bernard will know this as well, being in the rugby background, like long before we were talking about bubbles and support bubbles in COVID, professional sports people have lived like that in terms of how they look after themselves, how they operate, how we travel in the game, so every single minute detail is taken care of, so all they have to focus on is performing. And professional sports people are so used to living in these bubbles, and it does seem, strikes me just from speaking to people who kind of, it just strikes me that sometimes I think they just live sometimes in their own little world, and it's kind of hard to fathom some of the stuff that you're hearing. Like the whole vaccine thing and this hesitancy, it's not actually a new thing. Like, it was put to me that even around flu season, lads don't want to get a flu jab. Like, it's just little things like this. And like one of the points that was made was, they were told, well, if you get the vaccine, then you're not going to have to get tested. But the testing is still happening, even for those players who have the vaccine, and they're getting tested twice a week. And there's a sense almost that, especially in Premier League dressing rooms, and how it was put to me was, it's almost as if the Premier League, who are maintaining and staying on top of things, and rightfully, which they should be doing, but it's almost as if they're getting the sense that the only reason that they're doing it is to keep the show on the road, so there's not another kind of stoppage, and to keep the money rolling in.
Yeah.
And we've seen it already with another takeover in a club. It's that's what talks in professional sport, and nowhere else bigger than the Premier League.
So the figures are that fewer than half of players at most Premier League and English Football League clubs have been vaccinated. But rugby, that's not the story at all, Bernard. So the IRFU released a statement yesterday, and they said that 99.2% of those involved in the professional game have received at least one dose of the vaccination. So the uptake is much bigger in the rugby ranks.
Yeah, but it's much easier, in fairness, like IRFU central contracts, everybody reports to one boss. It's a small enough, it's whatever, 50 or 60 players, and I said the ability to communicate to everybody through the simple message and singular message is a lot easier in Ireland, obviously across all the Premiership, Championship clubs. It's a lot more difficult, and if the clubs aren't being strong on it, I think it's obviously hard for Kenny. But I agree with you, I think he could have obviously made a stand. But the biggest issue is, as you say, is like, at least if you're in a club, you're in Newcastle United, to use them, you're effectively in that bubble. So if there's 50% of the players not vaccinated, you're kind of hanging around with them. The support staff are the same people, whereas for an international camp, you know, you're, the cross pollination of people is massive, so it's probably more dangerous as such. So it's fascinating. Sorry, it's a shock to me how low the percentage is. You know what I mean? You think these lads whose seasons have been curtailed, or careers, you know, their earnings might be in jeopardy if there's another stop, would just be the first guys in the queue. But
And the interesting thing is, I find, you're saying about 150, I think Chelsea probably have about 150 players just out on loan. But like, it's one thing is, but what the Premier League captains and clubs have shown is it actually, they are very capable of mobilising on a singular issue and getting together. Where if you look back to what would have happened with Project Restart when football was coming back after COVID, and also when you look at what was happening with the Black Lives Matter movement and how they were very keen to make that stand and were absolutely on the ball, they led the way. Like, those captains, and Seamus Coleman was one of those in that WhatsApp group, and Jordan Henderson and all the rest, and they were talking about it, but it came out that these lads were leading the way by making sure that they were able to stand up for what's right in terms of respecting every single person with the Black Lives Matter movement and making sure that those voices were heard. So I do think that more could have been done on this in terms of getting ahead of it and leading the way. But clearly, again, as was put, there can be voices in dressing rooms that can lead a charge, and there'd be certain people in dressing rooms would be sheep or our followers, and that's also an element here as well. And it's very frustrating, and even from a point of view of, if you look at lads coming over to represent their country, and like say when the game obviously on Tuesday against Qatar, when there's going to be hopefully a decent crowd in the Aviva Stadium, like the people who will be turning up to that stadium have had their lives turned upside down, would have been through immense suffering, would have lost family members, would have lost loved ones, and then they're seeing lads representing their country and being out on that pitch who maybe aren't willing to make a small sacrifice for the greater good. It sticks in my throat, and I don't think it's right.
Well, I'm sure that those who have opted not to take it have their reasons, and they are entitled to them. They are individuals, and whatever decisions they want to make, I think that they are entitled to make them and should be. Bernard, speaking of individuals, it was great to hear Andy Friend stand up after the Bulls director of rugby, Jake White, had a bit of a pop at Connacht and said that many of the players in Ireland use Connacht as a bit of a backdoor to try and get into other provinces. And Andy Friend came out fighting, and he said that the comments were ill-informed and he was pretty disappointed in them. But it does seem like there is a perception out there of Connacht rugby that might not be reflective of where it is now.
Yeah, I think Jake let himself down. I think I'd heard that they were, when they got to Galway, they were saying, oh, it's like Kimberley, which is like a really, how would you say, unglamorous mining town in South Africa. And by all accounts, they just stayed like on the outskirts. They went to the sports ground, which compared to the Aviva Stadium, compared to Loftus, and the huge stadiums in South Africa, it's not as impressive. But they didn't go and actually down to town and see Connemara or Barna or whatever. So, you know, when I heard that, I was like, oh, these lads are in for some shock. And then his pre-match interview was very disrespectful. But look, the only thing you can do is give it back to him in spades, and the players did on the pitch. And like, for Connor to go away with a bonus point, Bulls to go away with their pants down, that's the perfect response to that. And Andy Friend, in fairness to him, it's his fourth year in Connacht. He's become part of the community. He's very proud of what they're trying to achieve. He knows the limitations budget wise but the players give everything they have, and it was disrespectful. But look, Jake's ego is out of control, you know. And you know, anyone who speaks about himself in the third person, you know, there's lots of self belief. So it's the perfect response, and he knows now that Connacht isn't just a team of rejects.
Yeah, well, they play the Dragons at the weekend, and as you said, the best thing they can keep doing is going out and winning matches. But I do enjoy that little bit of beef. I think it always just adds to the spice.
Yeah, and Jake is going to be good for the tournament. Like, whether we like him or not, he will call it as he sees it, and he'll put himself out there to be shot at, and the Bulls will get better. But yeah, I think it's disrespectful, but in some ways it adds a little bit to the spice.
Then Leinster are playing Zebra on Saturday, and it's very rare that we're in a position where we're saying that we need Leinster to bounce back from a poor performance, but they were poor last weekend, and it will be interesting to see if they can raise it up pretty quickly, really.
Yeah, I'd say the review yesterday or Tuesday morning was a rare tense environment for Leinster, because usually they're on the front foot, you know, for most games, and it was poor. But having said that, I think Leo Cullen and Stuart Lancaster will say that they've been, you know, winning games, you know, with the handbrake on over the last 3 years in the Pro 14 hasn't helped them win Europe. So, you know, every battle they get into is going to be an opportunity to understand how to get out of it. And they did get out of it. They won the match. The conditions were, I was over there, the conditions were horrendous. They just started to make some Moncarrick District errors, and it became contagious. And early in the season, you don't have your rhythm, you don't have your, you know, you're not completely in the zone, and you're not going to be at your best. So, and also he made a few changes from the week before, so I can see why it happened. But yeah, Zebra are going to get the backlash this Saturday.
One of the big talking points over the weekend, or from the weekend, was the fact that the Leinster had decided to swap their props, Andrew Porter and Keen Healy. Robin McBride was asked about it in the media this week, and he says the early signs have been quite positive.
Oh yeah, Andrew Porter's going to be a very good loose head. That's where he started, and it will allow Leinster. The thought process is that Andrew Porter was ending up sitting on the bench for 60 minutes for Ireland and Leinster in the big games, when realistically you want him on the field. So him moving back to loosehead allows Leinster to theoretically have Andrew Porter loosehead, Ronan Kelleher at hooker, and Tadhg Furlong a tight head, which is very, very strong. And then it also looks like Keane Healy is going to be more than a useful tight end as well, which is the added bonus. So, yeah, that'll work out perfectly for them.
A lot of the, I suppose, the analysis of Munster really over the last couple of weeks has been celebrating Zeebo or Snyman. But it was interesting to hear Donal Lennon say that, you know, you can have all these players, but without Joey Carberry playing well, Munster are going to be in trouble.
Yeah, and he wasn't at his best on Saturday. He's definitely trying to find his way. Very talented player. Now, in fairness, the game, like, they went 15-0 down and they had to change tact. But I wouldn't be worried about Joey Carberry. Joey Carberry will find his rhythm, and he will be a key man for Munster as long as he stays fit. If he's on the field, he'll produce some magic.
And then the first game of the weekend is Ulster and Benetton.
Yeah, tomorrow night, Benetton are back. Obviously won the Rainbow Cup at the end of the season. I think it's great for the league. The Welsh look better, the Scots look better, and Benetton have had two from two. Got a last-minute drop goal last weekend to beat Edinburgh. Going to Ravenhill is going to be tough for them, but they're a good side, full of Italian internationals, and have started to build a little bit of momentum. So, yeah, should be a good game.
Okay, Bernard, thank you for all of that. Plenty to look forward to on the rugby front over the next few days. We're going to take a very quick break now, and then we're back with more football.
Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. I am in studio with journalist David Snaid. David, we were speaking a little bit earlier about the Saudi takeover of Newcastle United. There has been a huge reaction from Newcastle United fans for obvious reasons, but just even seeing Alan Shearer tweeting, yes, we can have hope again, would say you'd be a little bit happy for the Newcastle fans. But the reality, though, is that, you know, they are selling out to a regime that is quite disturbing.
Well, that's it. You only have to look even this week at the fact that Amnesty International have come out and wanted the Premier League to try and to block this deal. And the fact is that the Premier League have only approved the takeover because we look reading here that they received legally binding assurances that the Saudi state wouldn't actually control Newcastle. So it's actually a public investment fund that are actually providing 80% of the funds for the £300 million deal. You've got Amanda Staveley, who basically has... She's been the front and centre of this takeover for the last 4 years, really. Like, she has been the one like driving this as a really impressive, serious businesswoman. And if you look at the fact that how long this has taken to come to fruition, and there's also the Rubin brothers, kind of billionaires, have serious amount of property around Newcastle and that area. Like, they own a big, massive shopping centre right in the heart of the city centre. They own a Newcastle racecourse. And then you look as well, obviously, this investment fund coming in, and it seems to be a case that this is going to be transformative, not just for the club, but for the area in and around the northeast, which I would imagine is one way that they've managed to get politicians on side with this too in the local area. Because if you look at what Manchester City did, it's not like Abu Dhabi just came in and focused everything solely on the club. They've kind of tried to reach out in and around the whole that kind of East Manchester and redevelop the local economy, which has been a huge success. And as Alan Shearer talking about hope, there has been no hope for Newcastle fans. But then there will be people, a lot of people on the outside who have no affinity to Newcastle United, will be despairing, because even though the Premier League have given the okay for this deal because it's going to be, there's insurances there that it's not going to be controlled by the Saudi state. It's still a serious amount of money coming in from this investment fund in a country that has human rights record on gay rights. You see what's happened with journalists. So
women.
And women as well.
They're not big fans of women either.
We're laughing, but it's just... It plays into what's the
reality, though, which is quite frightening. I know we can just sit here and talk about it and, you know, almost flippantly say, well, they're anti this, they're anti that. But there is a whole lot of people living in that regime and suffering in that regime.
Well, it's an element. It is. It comes down to what it is, sports washing and this whole element of soft power in terms of using the club in a Premier League to give you a bit more credibility. So... it's just that's essentially what this is. It's been happening throughout Europe, but even if you look in the Premier League, like there's so many takeovers that have happened where clubs have been leveraged, not even using their own money to buy the club, owners coming in and clubs being like decimated. You only look at Derby County, who have gone into administration of the Championships, one of the most famed club in English football, club Brian Clough, serious success back in the day, and like they're in absolute disarray. Look at Liverpool. They've been taken over, obviously, by FSG in Boston, having almost been run into bankruptcy by George Gillette and Tom Hicks only less than 10 years ago. You look at what's happened at Manchester United with the Glazer takeover, all these leveraged takeovers. Even recently, if you look at the moment where Newcastle are in the Premier League, they're second bottom. The team who was just above them on the league, just on goal difference, is Burnley. They've recently been taken over by an American investment firm. And it hasn't even been their own money. The club, if you read the reports that have been in the Guardian about this, like it's already a mortgage on Turf Moor to pay for a takeover of their own club, and the club's own cash reserves used to pay the shareholders who've sold their shares. And so, if you're looking at it from the point of view of from the supporters, they've now got an absolutely incredible now amount of wealth that's coming into this club. They know that they're on a solid footing in the sense that it's not a case of this is a leverage buyout. It's, you look at what's happened with Manchester City over the last 10 years and how that club is just being transformed by what happened with Abu Dhabi and the potential that is there in Newcastle. Like chatting about this before we came on air, and if you're lucky enough to ever go to a game in Newcastle, like it's literally St James's Park looks over the city at the top of a hill. And it's just like a mecca. It really is. It's actually incredible. And you go to that stadium and you see the passion that those supporters have had and what they've had to deal with over the last 15 years. Alan Shearer spoke about hope. And if that's how they feel, and I said it earlier, you'd have to have a heart of stone not to see a bit of joy for them. And maybe it's just because of everything that's happened over the last 20 years in the Premier League and however the demographics have changed with the finances that's come involved, but you just expect something like this now. It's not a major shock. It shouldn't be a surprise, and that's just how football at the elite level is.
Yeah, well, we are joined now on the line by former FAI chief exec and now chief exec of the Welsh FA, Noel Mooney. Noel, how are you?
I'm great, Marie. Greetings from Prague, the capital of the Czech Republic, where we play tomorrow night.
I was going to ask you, actually, where in the world you are, but you've answered my question. Look, we're going to get into your job, which is relatively new, I guess, in a second, but we've just been chatting there about the Saudi takeover of Newcastle. And just from, I guess somebody that is quite close now to the Premier League in terms of proximity. Anyway, Noel, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I was just following the story earlier today, actually, on the way here. I think that move had been mooted a couple of years ago, and there was issues around it, of course. We've seen a huge influx of money from the Emirates. China, at one stage, which seems to have dried up a little bit, and certainly from the US. I don't think it's a surprise that it's a move into English football, because if you look at the Emirates, for example, their investment in Manchester City has brought them credibility, I guess. That very few other things could do. So it's no surprise to see Saudi Arabia investing in English football. Profile-wise, it's fantastic for them. If they do a good job with Newcastle and they win trophies, what a great club to be involved in. I'm not going to get into the rights and wrongs of it, to be honest. I don't work for human rights on this one and have my own views, but I think that's for other people to to give comment on, but I mean, I can understand very much why they want to do that. Newcastle is a great club, it's a historic club, and it would be great for them if they get it right there for sure.
But just even from, look, a sports administrative point of view, when there are, look, it's sports washing now, really. Like, there's no getting away from it. There is atrocities going on in some of these countries, and they are trying to camouflage what they're doing, really, by associating themselves with things that are good in the world, and that is sport. Is that a worry for you, that there is so much of it going on in not just football? Like, there's other events as well. We've seen it in boxing, we've seen the golf go to some of these countries as well, and we're probably going to see a lot more sports follow suit as well.
Yeah, it's the way of the world. I don't know who is to judge, you know, whether a country does the right thing or the wrong thing. We see investments by a lot of these countries in big sport events. I understand, as I say, why they do it. But again, who is the moral judge of who's right and who's wrong on this thing? There's the fit and proper person test they tried to do quite a while back. I don't know how effective that was, to be honest with you. But if you ask fans, for example, of Chelsea, are they happy that Roman Abramovich took over the club all them years ago? And what he has done with the club has been remarkable, to be fair. Are people happy, for example, I don't know this, the Emiratis took over Manchester City, what they've done with the club? Would Man City fans be happy? They'd be very happy. And I'm sure if Newcastle, you know, if they win trophies and succeed with Saudi ownership, they'll be very happy as well. And again, you know, if you want to go into discussions about what the country does in itself, I think that's a different argument myself. I think it's very taking them out of high ground to say a country or a company can't invest in something because we judge something wrong. I think it's a very difficult thing to do to stop someone investing. But I do know that the Saudi investment was delayed for quite some time. I don't know the details of whatever that process was, but it would certainly be interesting to know.
It is really difficult because I know myself that if Ireland qualified for the World Cup in Qatar, I'd be over there in a flash. So it's not like I can sit here and pass judgment either, because I would get on the bandwagon with that. And I did go to the Club World Cup as well when Liverpool were playing there. So look, I do find it difficult as well myself, because, you know, if I, you know, I probably should have taken a stand and said, no, I'm not going to go. But then I'm just a person then that buys into the sports watching as well, because I just go along with it. But anyway, no.
It's very tricky. I think it's important, because if you look at in my previous role, so recent UEFA, we had the Norwegian FA went to a vote. Basically, it was fans group that raised concerns about going to Qatar, and it got right to the edge of a vote where it could have been the fans voting if Norway did qualify to go to Qatar, that they wouldn't go, they would boycott it, and they would ask the association to boycott it, and that led to, that would have led to all sorts of things, like, for example, Norway not playing the qualifiers, maybe, then that leaves the group in a different state. So I think there's some very tricky decisions to make. You hope that the right decisions are made, but there are complex processes behind that that I don't think we have time to discuss.
It probably needs a whole hour show, Noel. So look, you have the big job now in Wales, and I think as Irish people, we love to see our own doing well abroad. So how's it been going for you?
So far, so good. The people in Wales are very welcoming. I thought it was a really attractive role because they've had a lot of success at the men's level in 2016, 2020. They qualified for Euro as well. They have a lot of talent coming through, 17s and 19s. But also we're on the cusp of, I think, a lot of success for the women's national team and underage teams as well. So we have started the group really well. We've got a very talented women's national team squad. But then, I suppose, we launched our strategy last Monday called Our Wales, which has six big objectives. You can boil it down to three big ones, which is growing participation from 90,000 players to 120, doubling the women's game, and that means investment, attendances, participation, etc. And the other one is building grassroots facilities across Wales. So we're currently doing an audit of the whole country to see where we need to build pitches, where we need to build pavilions or dressing rooms, where we need to renovate pitches, recarpet them, etc. So what will come in from that is a big number. We're in discussion now with the Welsh Government, the UK Government, the 22 local authorities, and looking at our own reserves and that to see what we can put together to develop pitches across Wales. So we need that, because there's waiting lists, there's loads of our grassroots clubs.
girls and boys to play football, but we just don't have enough facilities. So that's our big goal in the next 5 or 6 years, to build enough facilities to cater for that demand for football. But football is really strong there. It's an interesting country because we say about Ireland having a quick flight to, say, Liverpool or Manchester. Wales is even trickier because it's literally on its doorstep. And we have clubs playing in the English Championship, for example, in Wales. That is good and bad. It means that our own Cymru Premier Division is literally right beside English Championship and First Division clubs and so on and so forth. But also, it's good for us in terms of development because it means that we've got these Premier League standard academies in our countries. Plus, we have our own development academy. So we've got a really good conveyor belt pipeline of talent coming through both at boys and girls level. So there's pluses and minuses to being right on the doorstep of England, but certainly the future looks very good. We have a lot of talent coming through, so we're very positive about the future of our football, for sure.
What are the biggest challenges that you've faced since you took over?
Well, I would say that putting everybody onto one direction, because like any country in Western Europe, there's lots of forces and lots of politics involved. But actually, I've been really happy with how getting the strategy out front quite quickly, aligning everyone behind this one plan. So basically, one Welsh football, all different stakeholders working together. That was a concern that we might be able to get them together. And that doesn't mean just the football parties, it also means the government, the local authorities, Sport Wales and all that. So we've managed to get them together pretty quickly. I think it's been quite positive over the last 5 or 6 weeks, putting the strategy out there, getting everything consulted, which had been happening before I got there. I was helping them from the UEFA perspective on the strategy. So I knew it, but I didn't know when I was working on it back then that I would actually be delivering it and launching it. So the challenges we face, as I mentioned to you, the fact that England is really on our doorstep, the fact that we have a bit of work to do with our own Cymru Premier Division and our women's top flight as well, to develop that and to build that as well. The Federation is actually in a very good financial position. We have good reserves, which we are considering now about the future of facilities, putting a big fund together for grassroots facilities to develop the sport further. But yeah, I think that overall the Football Association of Wales is in a good condition. My job will be to take it from a good association to one of the best in Europe, to be seen as a thought leader in how we market the game, in terms of how we develop players, in terms of how we governance the game and so on and so forth. So like, there's a lot ahead to do. We've laid out our roadmap for the next 6 years to 2026, and we are determined to deliver it. We've got a very good team. There will be some change management and some realigning of different parts of the game for sure. But once we've that done in the next 12 months, we really will be rocking it then.
Do you see similarities between Ireland and Wales and I guess just the challenges that are faced in both countries and associations?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you look at facilities at grassroots level, for example, I think both countries have a long way to go to get where we need to get. I mean, I lived in Switzerland for the last 10 years. I travelled around a lot of Europe. And certainly in Ireland and Wales, we've a lot of work to do to build the kind of facilities that particularly young girls would want to go and play in, you know, proper female-friendly dressing rooms and surfaces and so on and so forth. But we also have English, the juggernaut of English football, on both of our doorsteps. I think we're similar in terms of the talent that we're producing. I think Ireland are producing a lot of very good talent. I know that the pathways are certainly there. In Wales, we have a very strong talent ID system. We have up to 30 scouts every week going across the UK looking for more talent for Welsh youth teams. I think we've got a very good system to get them into our national team squads and wanting to stay there, which is very important. And I think that we are both in the same position with the female game. So I think participation is rising quite quickly, both in Ireland and in Wales. Our national teams are developing pretty quickly. So yeah, we're actually quite similar in terms of size. And I suppose the difference with us at the minute is that our national teams are qualifying for major tournaments, which makes a difference in lots of ways, interest in the game, finances, sponsors, all that kind of stuff. So we're quite fortunate in Wales that we do have a huge amount of interest. We really are at the front of the media agenda as well, even though there's plenty of rugby there as well. But we're financially in a good position, and I think we've a lot of talent to deliver for us over the next few years to continue in that vein.
Noel, how are you? Davis Knight here in studio. How are you keeping?
How are you? You all right?
Yeah, I'm good. Just on that, and you're talking about maybe those similarities in challenges. Obviously, you've been in there with the FAO. Like, would you have had a chance to chat with Jonathan Hill in terms of just tick-tacking together on where things will be going? And what could be...
Yeah, definitely. I'd be friendly with Jonathan. I would know Jonathan from his previous life with the English FA when I was a UEFA, for sure. And certainly with the FAI, they're going very much in the right direction. They've really moved on in terms of governance. There's a really good board in place. I think the FAI are set for a lot of success going forward. They have some challenges, and your national team is not qualifying for tournaments. That's a problem. I think I'm sure it's been debated to death there, this Stephen Kenny story and what he's trying to build with the national team. And that takes time and it takes patience. Wales, thankfully, we have that. We are successful. We're missing Gareth Bale and Ben Davies and David Brooks for the match tomorrow night, but we've got a very strong young squad going out there. I'm sure that Ireland, and I know from talking to Jonathan, there is the confidence that they'll get there, that they will over time get to where they need to get to. I think that a strategy they need to launch, I would say, early next year. We've just been able to do it a bit quicker, I suppose, because it had been worked on earlier. So I'll be looking forward to seeing what the FAI strategy is when it's launched early next year, and I have every confidence that the staff there and the team in the FAI will deliver that with the excellent board they have in place, yeah.
Okay, well, Noel Mooney, thank you for joining us, and best of luck with the qualification process as well over the next little while. We'll be back tomorrow. We will have live updates on the Ireland Under-21s with Paul Corrie, and Gavin Casey will be with us to talk boxing, Jane Mangan on racing, and live to Oriel Park ahead of Dundalk versus Rovers. David Snay, thank you so much for coming in. Tara Kumar is up next.
Green Farm. Have your dinner ready in a flash with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet. Available in selected stores nationwide.